The Future Proof Podcast from Newstalk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to contact us, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter, we're at Newstalk Science. We get to all of those emails and tweets. We do read them and appreciate them later on in the podcast. So if you have a question, a comment, criticism, any other thing beginning with a C, we will read it. We may not necessarily broadcast it, but we'll read it. So coming up on this episode, we're going to be speaking to Mike Berners-Lee, a very clever sort of environmental activist, and does a huge amount of work in sort of trying to understand how our planet works, systems work, and then trying to translate them into things that we can do in the environment. And his brother is one of the people who invented the internet. So very smart family. So Tim Berners-Lee is one of the people credited with bringing about the internet, for which you can clap him on the back or push him down some stairs, depending on your view. So we're going to be speaking to Mike about his book, Planet B. There is no Planet B, is the idea that we're just basically screwing up here. And there's not, it's not like, as we've sort of, I mean, on this program, we've kind of talked about living on, I hope we've never given anyone the impression that there is another planet out there, that when we're done with this one, we can just hike off to Mars or live on the moon or there's nothing. This is it, right? Just in case, because actually there was a couple of things on the internet over the, on Twitter over the last while, people saying, you know, we can't go anywhere else. Just for maybe younger listeners, this is it. So be good. So we're going to talk to Mike Berners-Lee. But before that, it's time to have a look at the week's science news. And joining me in studio is Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and Phil Smith, science broadcaster and communicator. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
Dearest Vincent, I know you don't know who I am.
I'm your brother, Julius.
Huh? Come again?
My name is Julius, and I'm your twin brother.
Oh, obviously. The moment I sat down, I thought I was looking into a mirror.
We are not identical twins.
Oh, no?
No.
Well, I wouldn't be too sure, pal. What is this, candid camera?
You know, the thing about Arnold Schwarzenegger is that I think we're going to look back on that man very kindly. And at the height of his career, I never thought that. But I think history would be quite kind, Arnold Schwarzenegger. That's Danny DeVito and Arnold Schwarzenegger in Twins. And this story is about twins that aren't twins.
They're not twins. No, they're semi... Well, they are twins, but they're not fraternal twins or they're not identical twins. So those are the two common type of twins that we talk about. These are semi-identical twins, or in a nice new word that I had to look up this morning, sesquizygotic twins.
Easy for you to say.
And sesqui is a new prefix, which means one and a half. So like a sesquicentennial is 150 years, just in case.
Sesqui.
Yeah, just in case. They're a new word for your vocabulary. But this story, it was published this week, but it's actually about a pregnancy that happened back in 2014. So doctors in Brisbane were treating a pregnant woman and they identified that she was having twins at about 6 weeks. And these twins shared a placenta. So it was presumed that they were identical twins, i.e. a fertilized egg that with one egg, one sperm that had split and formed two identical, essentially clones, which is what identical twins are. But then the sort of the plot thickened because an ultrasound later in the pregnancy revealed that one baby was a boy and one was a girl.
And it is tricky to be an identical twin when one is a boy and one is a girl.
It's pretty much impossible.
Right.
So at that point, they did genetics tests to try and sort of work out what was going on. And what they worked out was that one egg had been fertilized by two sperm cells. This is incredibly unusual to end up in a live birth. So human cells basically carry two copies of each chromosome, but sperm cells and egg cells only carry one copy. Eggs can only carry X chromosomes and sperm can carry either X or Y. So we know that the sperm cell determines the gender of the baby or the sex of the baby. But in this case, two sperm cells, one carrying an X and one carrying a Y chromosome, fertilized one egg. And then after fertilization...
Because I thought when the sperm made it to the egg, I think I got this from Look Who's Talking.
We're really going to like 80s movies here today.
I really should not be like saying this is where I'm grounding the science up. But I thought like once the sperm made it in, like the egg shuts down.
Well, technically yes, but so I think that's why this is so rare. This must have happened sort of at exactly the same moment before the egg could shut down. And I think the other thing that's so unusual and why this is so rare, because after fertilization, the chromosomes pair up. That's what happens. But in this case, it worked out that the sperm separated and some of it got paired up with the female DNA and some got paired up with male. And the male to male eggs or cells that formed died, leaving behind actually male and female paired up genetic material in cells. And as those eggs grew and divided, they split into two balls. And both of those balls ended up as viable groups of cells and developed into babies.
So you're saying that there's sort of a floating genetic material, because DNA, I think, was described last week quite well as a sort of like a zipper, where you know,
exactly,
if you have letters on either side and they sort of stick together. And so you're saying sort of free genetic material managed to sort of clump together in the right way to create two different individuals.
I mean, the X and Y chromosome are a pair of chromosomes, even though the X chromosome is much, much bigger than the Y chromosome. But they join up together. They act like two parts of a zipper. But in this case, you know, it's just so unusual that all of those things happen. The two sperm entering the egg at the same time, that they were able to get in, the DNA pairing up in the way that it did, parts of the cells dying, and then the embryo splitting. Now, the story kind of got a little bit more complicated. So as the children were born, what they realized is that the little girl actually had some complications. She had a blood clot, and actually had to have an arm amputated quite soon after she was born. And then they realized that her ovaries hadn't formed properly when she was about 3 years old.
Right.
So actually, there wasn't a perfect division of the cells. One embryo got a much higher proportion of XX cells and became female, but actually still carried XY material.
How often has this happened in history?
This is only the second recorded time. So the last time was in the US in 2007, but this is the only time it's ever being diagnosed in utero.
Wow. Our second story has to do with a teenager. Now, I have to say, when I sometimes enter my children's room, and my boys are only 7 and 4, I should point out.
Right.
It does look like they have created a nuclear reaction, right? But this is a different type of nuclear reaction.
It's a different type of nuclear reaction. It's one to do with fusion and fission. Like, we need energy, and there's various issues in the world of, you've normal kind of fuel that we kind of get from oil or whatever, that's toxic. Nuclear reactors produce nuclear waste if they're fission, and solar, we don't have the batteries to store all of the energy. So fusion works in the same way to fission, which splits out by firing neutrons at it and overcoming the strong interactive force, and that's where you get your energy from.
The way I describe fission is,
yes,
you've got a really volatile thing that you sort of want to split apart.
Yes.
And fusion is, you've got a really strong thing that you want to stick together.
Yeah, and they oppose that force. And in order to get them to stick together, you have to have great speed to fire them together to go overcome that repelling force. To increase that speed, you need great heat or great pressure. And that's what the sun is able to do, because it's so massive that it has such a great pressure that it's able to overcome it. Whereas here, we can't recreate that pressure, so we need to recreate the temperature.
And if we get fusion, if we figure out how to make fusion on an industrial scale, we have solved the world's energy problems.
Yeah, free energy with no waste is kind of where we're looking at. So there's billions being invested in this. And what's really interesting is that a boy aged 14, a guy called Jackson Oswald from Memphis in Tennessee, has built one himself. He's 14.
Okay, so
and he bought the parts on
eBay. eBay. This is ridiculous.
So how is it, like, how come we haven't, if a 14-year-old boy can build it from stuff in his, it's about 10 grand worth of stuff, right?
About 10 grand worth of stuff. Now, there is an open source fuser research consortium where they kind of share some of their plans, and they you can try to build this. Now, obviously, billions is being invested into it, and you're kind of go, well, how are they not being able to? They have been able to build these reactors. They're just not getting more energy out than they were putting in, because right, they have to reach these huge temperatures. And they've different, like, stellarators or other things that are trying to arc these plasmas to fit together. The really, I suppose, interesting thing about this is that a 14-year-old saw something on his line, invested in it, did it out himself, and came up with the results. It's also kind of sparked kind of interesting thing that he's using deuterium, deuterium, which is an isotope of hydrogen, which is very plentiful on Earth, and particularly in salt water, and so much so that they think that you, from about a gram of this, that you could be able to produce about the equivalent of 12,000 kilos worth of coal's output in terms of energy.
It's extraordinarily beneficial if we can crack the
beneficial
energy
and plentiful.
It's in water, which is kind of crazy.
It's in water. Now, you need to pair it with something, and then the other things that you're like tritium, which is a radioactive substance, there's only about 20 kilos of that on Earth, mostly in warheads. So they need to pair it with something, and where they think they might be able to get it is in helium-3. There's not much of that on Earth either, but there could be potentially loads of it on the moon. So they think that from the solar winds that there's helium-3 building up over time, and we could eventually go to the moon, mine it, and then send it back to Earth and fuel our fusion reactors for thousands of years.
So I can imagine this 14-year-old's parents knocking on the bedroom door. What are you doing in there? Fusion.
Yeah. Get out of here.
Our third story is really a remarkable piece. It's about using nanomaterials to essentially give a superpower to animals.
It is. It's superhero mice. So this was a scientist at the University of Science and Technology of China and the University of Massachusetts Medical School, and they injected nanoparticles into the eyes of mice, and they have given them the ability to see infrared light for 10 weeks with seemingly no side effects to the rest of their vision or their functioning. So, I mean, as we know, humans and other animals are limited to seeing what we sort of creatively call visible light, because it's visible to us. That's essentially the wavelengths that are in the rainbow, that spectrum. But there's other radiation and light which has a longer wavelength and a shorter wavelength. So the longer wavelength light is infrared radiation. It's all around us, but we can't see it. So normally when light enters the eye and it hits the retina, the back of your eye, there's special cells called rod and cone cells. They absorb the photons of light and send an electrical signal to your brain. But in this study, the scientists made nanoparticles that basically stick all around these special cells in the eye. They coated the nanoparticles with a protein that binds to the sugar and proteins that are in the cells of your eye. And it's such a clever experiment, because when infrared light hits the retina, these nanoparticles act as little transducers, and they basically change the wavelength of the infrared light from a long wavelength around 980 nanometers to a wavelength of about 535 nanometers, which we can see as green light.
What would you see then? Sort of green shadows, or?
Well, I mean, obviously they're mice, so there was a whole thing working out.
Well,
you can't ask them what they're going to see. But I mean, what's clever about this is it's just using your normal eye and brain circuitry, because these little nanomaterials just emit then a photon that we can see, which goes to the brain. So they did some clever things. They basically showed that the mice's pupils dilated when they were shown infrared light, which means they could see the light, and they could also see that the cells in their eyes were lighting up. But they also trained them to get out of a water maze, which is often done with laboratory rodents. And they used shapes that were projected above the maze so they could find their way out. And they could stick to these animals can see rudimentary shapes in infrared, so circles and squares, that kind of thing. So it's just a really amazing, clever experiment.
You sort of feel that this is probably happening right now with soldiers in the States. I mean, when you think about infrared vision, you immediately think of, you know, tactical use. But it is a very interesting idea. There's a lot of people who are trying to do similar things, these sort of biohackers. We spoke to one in the program a few years ago who had sort of diluted himself, his eyes, with a solution that gave him night vision for a while. There are people trying to sort of push past this, and I think it's a really interesting sort of trend, although quite dangerous. Like, some people have gotten, you know, have tried to give themselves an ability to see around corners with their fingers, and then ended up getting sort of infections in their hands, because this is just not something the body normally does. But I think maybe in 50 years we probably will see people who have sort of hacked themselves to give themselves abilities to do things that we can't do biologically.
Yeah, I mean, I think to call it simple might be an overstretch, but certainly it's very elegant, and, you know, one can imagine the opportunities from it.
Yeah, closer step to danger mouse, which is crucially important to me.
The final story is probably kind of killing an urban myth about music and creativity.
Yeah, so basically a study coming out of Lancaster University and Gävle in Sweden, thank you Ruth for helping me pronounce that, is saying that how listening to music significantly impairs creativity. And I suppose if you even think back to even when you were studying or trying to come up with ideas, you often would have listened to music as part of sometimes to either calm the mood yourself or give yourself a better mood or distract yourself. And what's actually finding is that these researchers have shown that participants really saw that their verbal skills went down when trying to do tasks, because they're trying to listen to what's happening within the songs, but not also when there's words in the songs, but also just because there's a pattern in the music.
Right.
So the researchers used three experiments, doing various verbal tasks to to either figure out what the effect of this was. They had background music with foreign, unfamiliar lyrics. They would have used instrumental music without lyrics and then music with familiar lyrics. And what they found is that they found strong evidence of impaired performance when playing background music in comparison to kind of quiet background music or background environmental conditions. So they're saying that you're in a library or a normal environment, you will be able to work better, come up with better ideas because your brain isn't necessarily being distracted.
How do you describe creativity, though?
Well, see, that's a good thing, is how do you measure this? So this is what they asked them to do, particular tasks, and pair. They gave them a set of words and then asked them to see what the link was between, or come up with something that rhymed or matched in to be like something that would sound good or would actually link all of the three to them together. So nearly more kind of problem solving as opposed to creating new ideas, because that definition of creativity is hard to really kind of nail down.
Yeah, I suppose we're coming up to a stage probably next month, people are going to be really starting to think about their leaving cert study and so on. Listening to music is generally just not good for creativity.
Not necessarily for creative. And the other question with this
is it good for studying?
So this is the other question. So this study didn't necessarily look at that. Now, there is kind of, even if you think of Pavlov's dog, where you used to ring a bell and then the dog used to salivate and you have that memory. So there is a different question to be asked about in terms of memory retention. Like in terms of content, when people speak, you only remember about 7% of content from a 10-minute talk. You really more remember the emotion and the feeling towards it. So if you are getting music to relax you when you study, that is a different thing than trying to be creative and come up with solutions.
So what I just said, forget that.
Yeah, totally.
Phil Smith, science broadcaster, and Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland. Thanks very much. The environment, it is complicated, in case you hadn't noticed. And we're trying to figure out what we need to do about things like global warming. And once you start going down a rabbit hole, it seems that there are lots of different factors at play. But we're going to focus on two now for this next piece, and they are energy and food. Mike Berners-Lee, he's a professor and senior fellow at the Institute for Social Futures at Lancaster University. He's the author of There Is No Planet B, and How Bad Are Bananas? And he's basically spent the last number of years examining the statistics and evidence and trying to figure out ways that we can sort of get a grip on a global warming, climate change, and what we can do about it. Welcome to the program, Mike. How are you?
Thank you. Well.
So when you wrote How Bad Is a Banana, you sort of pulled apart a lot of the things that I thought I was doing that were good for the environment. It sort of left me a little bewildered, to be honest, Mike, last time we spoke. So tell us about this book, There Is No Planet B. What were you trying to do with it?
Well, I mean, How Bad Are Bananas was trying to give people a sense of perspective on carbon footprint, because if we're going to manage our climate change impact, that's something basic that we need. But when you really look at the climate change problem, you find that If you really stand back as if you're standing on Mars and looking down on the planet Earth and looking at what we'd need to do to deal with it, you find that you need to look at it as a global, as part of a big global systemic challenge. And it's got not just science and technical dimensions to it, it's also got economic dimensions to it. And you have to ask yourselves, what would it take for our species to really start doing what it takes to get on top of the problem? So it turns out to be a big, there's a whole big global system dynamic going on, but it's also intertangled with things like our economics and inequalities and the need to feed the world and a whole load of other pressing environmental challenges that need simultaneously dealing with. So it's a kind of a real mixed up soup of stuff that we need to deal with all at once.
Yeah.
And There's No Planet B is an attempt to look at all of it in one go, because it doesn't work anymore to kind of look at one thing at a time, climate change here and population here and economics over there. We have to, like it or not, we have to mix it all up, see the whole thing together, and then take action.
You sort of make the point in the book that some of these issues we could solve tomorrow if we were just a bit more equitable with things like money. Like the food problem that we have, where people starve in some countries and are obese in others, that is not a huge problem except economically, right?
Yeah, that's right. So the book's full of sort of all sorts of statistics that I think make your eyes pop out on stalks, because on the one hand, it's all so solvable. You know, there's such a surplus of food and all the technologies we need in order to be able to transition our energy supply and feed everybody and look after our biodiversity and so on. You know, it's all there. But what stops us is the way that we're living. And if you look, for example, at climate change, we're going to need a global arrangement to leave all the fuel in the ground. And that takes you to the question of what would it take for us to be able to make a global arrangement like that. And it looks almost impossible without having a more equitable way of treating all the people in the world. And when you look at the food, there's a really reassuring surplus of food at the global level. But when you look at why some people go malnourished, it boils down to the fact that they don't actually have the money in the free market for the supply chains to bother getting nutrition to all the parts of the world that need it. So a lot of it tracks down to an equity issue.
So what do we need to survive, and what would be the biggest thing that we could do in the food sector to completely change? I mean, is it just everybody eating plants? Have we really figured that out? Is it as simple as that?
Well, let's have a look. So at the global level, we grow nearly 6,000 calories per person per day in human edible crops. That's around 2.5 times the amount that we need to eat. So that's fantastic news. And it's the same for all the other essential nutrients, protein and all the micronutrients as well. It's a huge surplus. So let's look at where they go. Well, some of them get lost in various forms of losses and wastes along the way. And clearly we should try and minimize that. And clearly that's important. But the biggest deal is that we feed nearly 1,800 calories per person per day for every person in the world of human edible calories to farm animals. And they also eat a whole lot of grass and stuff. But they give us back just a few hundred calories of energy and just a little bit of protein. So we take nearly an amount of food, which is nearly three-quarters of what the whole of humanity needs to eat, and we feed it to farm animals, and we get really just a little bit back in return from that.
Are you suggesting that we give them food that the humans couldn't eat in its place? And what would that be? I'm trying to imagine, like, this is brain-piece moment. We do that too
at the moment. So we feed farm animals nearly 4,000 calories per person per day for every human in grass, pasture, and stover that we couldn't eat but animals can. And we, on top of that, we feed them nearly 1,800 calories in human edible food, inherently human edible food. And if we could,
like, what, grains and stuff?
Yeah, that's grains and soybeans and maize and things that, you know, are digestible by humans. So if we could just cut that right down, we would immediately liberate we would create enormous space in the food system to make it easier to feed everybody, even when the population grows, to make it easier to manage our biodiversity, which is currently hemorrhaging, so we can create a lot more space for that biodiversity. We'll cut the carbon footprint enormously, and we can even have a little bit of biofuel, although we need to be really careful about our biofuel. So nobody needs to go vegetarian. Nobody needs to go vegan. It's just about proportions. It doesn't all have to be done straight away, but we do need to see big change over the next not very many years, over the next few years. And nobody stands to lose any health as a result at all. In fact, most of us could probably take this as an opportunity to make our diets more healthy. And as we get used to it, we won't enjoy our food any less at all.
But this is, you know, I suppose one of the biggest frustrations of people like Al Gore and I suppose citizens of this country and others looking at, you know, the changes that we could make that we can't because of things like shareholders and profit margins and so on. And that is a fundamental problem that will not go away. I mean, to basically solve global warming, looking at all the things you've looked at, or climate change, feeding the hungry, essentially you're looking for people who have sort of spent their lives accumulating wealth to turn around and be Samaritans.
Well, I'm not looking for anybody to sacrifice any well-being. I think overall we have a chance here to live better than we've ever lived and have more quality in our lives than we've ever had. But we do need to we do need to look absolutely at our economics. So suddenly, you know, the way we do our economics has been honed over millennia in an a context in which the planet was big and robust and humans were still a relatively small influence, and whatever we did, we couldn't smash the place up. And quite suddenly that's changed. Over the last few decades, we've become the big species that, if we're not very careful, we will smash the whole place up. And with that, that takes us into a context in which we need to re-examine everything about how we do life, and not least our economics.
Mm.
So you're absolutely right about businesses and the way that businesses run and the things that the reasons they exist and the pursuit of shareholder value, financial value, is absolutely inadequate in today's world as a reason for existence, and we do need to change that.
Let's talk a bit about energy, because I read, it was quite interesting, that we use 59 kilowatts of energy per day, is that right?
Yeah, that's at the global level, that's the global average. In countries like ours, it's more than that per person. And that's about, like, if you imagine setting fire to 6 litres of petrol per person every day, that'd be quite a big mess if you did that in your back garden. Yeah, that's what each of us...
That doesn't sound like a lot. I don't know. Is that am I a bad person, or am I just not able to imagine 6 litres of petrol?
It'd be quite a big fire.
yeah, it would be. I suppose it would be quite a big fire. But we use that amount of energy, and yet we could harness that energy very easily using solar. But the problem is, people don't want to use solar because it takes up a lot of space. Is it, or why are we so slow to harness solar?
Well, it's sort of a mystery. I mean, the technology has taken some time to really come of age, but it really has come of age now. And the price of solar panels is dropping through the floor, and there's no inherent bottleneck in the production of those panels to replace our entire energy supply. And if you just be slightly simplistic about it, a piece of land, 228 miles by 228 miles, full of solar panels anywhere in the world, could harness the same amount of energy as the humanity's entire annual energy supply. And,
wow.
You know, there are problems about transmission and storage and distribution and stuff like this. But all those problems, when you look at them, actually they turn out to be inherently solvable. So there's no reason why we don't do that. Why have we been so slow off the mark? Well, you have to blame the fossil fuel companies for dragging their heels on this and the vested interests that have been going around. Because, you know, whilst overall there are plenty of job opportunities and economic opportunities coming out of the green energy transition, there are a few parts of the economy that see a clear threat, and they've resisted it.
Mm.
So we need to see, we absolutely need to see a lot more energy going, a lot more of our human effort going into this transition. And we need to be clear with the fossil fuel companies that they need to be in rapid decline.
So, because I want to finish with something useful, I'm kind of struck by the idea that in the UK and the States, it's fine to kind of talk about this and it's real because, you know, large economies using a lot of power and so on, major world forces. In Ireland, I get the sense that there are people out there who go, doesn't matter if I recycle my flipping plastic, it doesn't matter if I use a keep cup or whatever, because we're a tiny country. And when you look at Argentina, you look at Brazil, you look at America, China, the waste and that's produced, the emissions, we really do not matter on an individual level. And I'd like you to sort of address
that. Let's answer that one head on. So, yeah, because when it's all so global and systemic, you know, every one of us, wherever we live in the world, is only, you know, you could say, well, we're only sort of one speck, 1/7.5 billionth of humanity. What can I do? But what we need to see is a big system change. And that's about economic change. It's about change of our energy system. It's about change in how we do economics, about how we change our politics. And it's about how we think, it's about how we respect people on the other side of the world, it's about how we demonstrate that with how we spend and invest our money and the things that we buy. It's about all sorts of stuff. And all of us can push to create the conditions under which that system change becomes more possible, both in how we live and also the pressure that we put on the businesses that we work for, the supply chains of the businesses we buy from, our politicians, our schools, all of that.
And I think that to me is one of the crucial points, is that as a person, if you demand it from the people around you and above you, then you start a sentiment, whether it's in your workplace or from your politicians. But if we think about the plastic bag levy that we've been dining out on for so long, that we were the first country to sort of put a price on plastic bags, it's had an enormous ripple effect around the world. Yeah, and if we can continue to be sort of a model and innovate and actually, show that things are possible and economically, possible.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think, Ireland, on the one hand, yes, you can say you're a fairly small country around the world, but you're absolutely big enough to be a role model. And there's plenty of people who would love to live in Ireland and would love to, aspire to an Irish lifestyle and so on. And you've shown with your plastic bags that you are a large enough country and you're significant enough that you can go and do something, you can prove that it works, and sure enough, you make it a lot easier for the rest of the world to follow in your footsteps. So go ahead and lead. Why not?
Fantastic. Mike Berners-Lee, author of There Is No Planet B, thanks very much. And next time there are people knocking on your door when it comes to elections or so on, if you care about this, maybe you should bring it up. How do you feel after that? Like, do you feel invigorated and charged and thinking like, we can do this, we can turn this around? Or do you feel depressed, like helpless? It's a funny one. The emotions that you feel when you think about everything. And I think I try not to think about everything too much, because it does upset me. And it can affect my mood if I think too much about everything that's going on. I read the newspapers a lot. I obviously read a lot of the environmental news. And anyway, I'm not going to cry. I promised myself I wouldn't cry. Not yet. Anyway, so to your emails and tweets. It's a bit disjointed this week, isn't it? Good God. We were talking about the brain's navigation system and how we manage to plot out where we are in the world. And we found this amazing fact, which was that in our brain, there are place cells. So there's a specific neuron for your kitchen that lives in your brain. And there's a specific neuron for James's Gate, if you've ever been there. But if you haven't been there, there isn't a neuron that fires for that. So there's a map for every place you've been, and it's made up of these place cells. Bonkers. Absolutely bonkers idea. So we were talking, I was asking, do people have good GPS? I'm quite good. I generally know where I came from. I can navigate back. If I've walked through a city, I can navigate myself back pretty well. My wife is terrible at it. She's better at almost everything else in life, but she's rubbish at finding her way home. Mairead Fitt says, give my dad, myself, or my brother rough directions and we'll find the place we're looking for. My mother, sister, and other brother are liable to get lost in a toilet stall. Thank God I've inherited internal GPS. Ah, but what have they got? What have they got, Mairead? We were speaking as well to Michael Leach about his book, where he basically spent a few weeks going back and forth, just trying to be amongst the gorillas, to communicate with them and trying to understand them in the deepest, darkest Africa. And as he did that, he was talking about habituation and how this was different because, you can go to guerrilla camps as a tourist and they're used to being around people and so on. And Pat from Moore and Moore says, so he visited one of the rare, truly wild guerrilla groups and then habituated them, that was sort of in my mind a little bit when I was listening to it. I was going, so these are sort of like an uncontacted tribe and you're going in there and just contacting them in a way. And it's a problem because obviously as a journalist or as a photographer, as a zoologist and wildlife enthusiast, you want to go and be and see these rare, beautiful creatures in the wild. But by doing that, do you change them forever? Is it like the sort of Schrodinger's gorilla that, that they are the way they are, but once you look at them, you've changed them forever? People are going to email in, oh, that's a rubbish analogy for Schrodinger's gorilla. But anyway, gorilla habituation is actually a bit more
involved. It's a process. It is actually a process by which a gorilla family get used to human visits over a period of 2 or 3 years. It involves an advanced team of trackers, conservationists, and researchers making regular visits to the family. And then the group is sort of established as being, it's almost like zooifying a gorilla in situ. And it's very different to popping along and then popping off. Will they remember him? Will they go, that was funny? What was that? What sort of animal was that? Maybe they won't. Maybe they just go, that was a strange animal. And maybe, like, you know, at the Christmas get-togethers, the gorilla group will go, do you remember that time that weird white gorilla came?
He did say that they remember him.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, maybe not habituated, but perhaps changed in their hearts forever. Thanks, Simon. And finally, we were talking about the reason why zebras/zebras have black and white stripes. And it turns out that it is to distract horseflies. This is the theory. Now, they haven't actually tested it with real horseflies, with real zebras in Africa. Bit of a litmus test to leap over there. But they did test them by using horses with horseflies and then putting zebra costumes on horses, which is just spectacularly funny. Someone tweeted in saying, if they can dissuade the Mayo Galway midges, I'm sure there'll be a rake of zebra tops in pennies. Finally, those biologists have done something practical. Clearly not a biologist, whoever tweeted that. That's it from us for this week. I hope you enjoyed the programme. Huge thanks to Simon Keane, who has been holding the fort, producing while producer Aidan McKelvey has been away. Seamless to you, of course, the listener, because, you know, that's just the way we roll. But it's not, you know, Simon's basically told, listen, by the way, I know it's not something you don't do very often, but you've just become a producer for 4 weeks. And it's, you know, it's a tricky job, particularly dealing with me. So thanks to Simon Keane, who's been producing. Aidan McKelvey is a series producer who's back next week. And in the box was Niamh Hassell. Peter Malloy was on sound. And that's all we have. Hope you enjoyed it. We will see you later in the week for more Future Proof Extra and Future Proof Gold. Find it where you found this one. In the meantime, stay curious.